AMM-FM.
Los Angeles.
Ladies and gentlemen, we proudly present the mayor of KGBS Los Angeles, Mr. Sam Yorty.
Well, good morning, and welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Here it is, Tuesday, July the 16th, as we proudly present the former Assemblyman, Congressman, and Mayor of Los Angeles for 12 exciting years, the one, the only Mayor Sam Yorty, now the official mayor of all of KGBS land. And, of course, Mayor Yorty is here every day, Monday through Friday, from 7 until 10, for one important reason, and that's to talk to you on the telephone. He wants to know what you're thinking about. You can express your opinions on any subject you choose. We have a 50,000-watt soapbox for you here, which is a pretty darn good thing that you can use. You can be heard way up in the San Francisco area, down around San Diego, all over Los Angeles, and you can speak up, express yourself, and really have an audience. So use this 50,000-watt soapbox. And now let's say hello to Mayor Sam. Good morning, Mayor.
Good morning, Wally. You're listening to my executive producer, Wally George. And at the controls, Ron Wyatt, in the studio helping us, my associate producer, Jonathan Coco, all here to do one thing, and that's to take your calls on 520-KGBS. Now today, I'm going to have a very special guest, John Farrar, who was featured in the book Teddy Bear. Mr. Farrar is the skin diver who recovered Mary Jo Kopechne's body from the lake, and he has some very startling things to reveal. He will also answer your question on the telephone. Now, what time is he going to be here, Wally?
He'll be here for the last hour from 9 to 10 to take the calls.
Well, you want to hear Mr. Farrar for sure.
The real story of Chappaquiddick, that's the one you've been hearing on the air this morning talking about it, Teddy Bear and Solzhenitsyn's great book are both available from your local American Opinion bookstore. Check the white pages of the telephone book for the American Opinion bookstore nearest you and buy Teddy Bear and Solzhenitsyn's book. Okay?
Solzhenitsyn's book, Gulag Archipelago.
Yes.
Which tells the history going clear back to Lenin of the use of jails to persecute the dissidents. Now, I guess it's very interesting. I didn't know they had it. I went to get that book.
It's a bestseller now.
Yeah, well, it should be. Now I want to introduce my special guest for today, Captain John Farrar, who's Captain of the Search and Rescue Department of the town of Egerton. And this is where the Teddy Kennedy episode all took place. And you were the individual who recovered Mary Jo Kopechne's body from the Senator Kennedy's car. How soon after the car went off the bridge were you called for help?
Well, Mayor Sam, first of all, I appreciate very much being here. It's been a nice trip out, and I certainly enjoy seeing California. As far as the accident itself, you wanted to know how soon after? Could I have the question again?
Well, how soon after the car went off the bridge were you called for help?
Well, this, of course, depends on who you particularly believe or the facts that you can come up with. And we could spend an awful lot of time going into that. But from all practical facts, it seems to vary depending on whether you believe Kennedy or whether you believe the facts that Huck Look has come up with, between 8 and 9 hours approximately, possibly even to 10 hours. But from the time that the accident happened to when we received the call.
Well, were you the first professional whose help us sought?
No, well, that's not quite true. The children, there were a couple of kids who were fishing down at the dike bridge where the car went off. They went down fishing early in the morning, and they summoned Mrs. Mom, and Mrs. Mom owns a dike house that is right next to the accident itself where the senator could have sought help. The lady who leaves her light on all night, I might add. And she called the police. She called the communication center, which is the central communication center for the whole island. They summoned the police to let them know that there was a car off of Dyke Bridge upside down in the water. Chief Arena was the first to go over there, and he donned a pair of Mrs. Mom's, probably Mr. Mom's, bathing trunks, and went over. He made a precursory examination of the car and attempted to go down to the window of the car, but was unable to because of the swift tide, and at that point he called us.
Oh, well, then, really, you were the first professional.
Well, as far as search and rescue goes, yes. Yeah. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to drag the question out,
yeah.
But I think of Chief Arena as a professional, not a professional in search and rescue, but he...
Yeah, he's a professional police officer, but not... I meant the search and rescue ability, which you were the first one to have that went looking for the body, I guess.
That's correct, Mayor Sam.
Well, how long do you think it would have taken to get professional help to the scene of the accident if Senator Kennedy had tried right away?
Well, there's no question about it. The time response would have been the same. From the time we received the call to the time we removed the body was 25 minutes. And if we had received it during the middle of the night or whenever the accident happened, it would have been approximately the same time.
Well, now, if an emergency rescue call had been placed that night, would you have participated in the rescue operations?
Oh, absolutely. There's no question about it.
Well, and if you had been called immediately after the accident, is there any reason to believe that Mary Jo Kopechnik's life could have been saved?
No, we frankly, from the conclusions that we've drawn since the accident or at the time of the accident when we were there, we feel that there is a very good chance, almost virtually 100% chance, that we would have saved Mary Jo's life. And there are numerous ways that we can come up with these conclusions. Although Kennedy hired engineering firms to defeat these conclusions or to come up with their own conclusions that she could not have been saved, we feel very strongly that she could have been saved, and we have I could go into quite a long dissertation on that of why we know she could have been saved.
Well, I think
you should. And we're backed up by the undertaker, as a matter of fact.
Well, I think you should go into it a little bit if you want to. That's a very important point.
All right, let me try and condense as much as I can, and you interrupt with any questions you have. We feel that, number one, by the way the car entered the water, in other words, it went in on its right side and top, and rolled virtually immediately and settled into the water, that there would have been copious amounts of air trapped within the automobile itself. Mary Jo was definitely alive and assumed a position in the back seat of the car. Whether she was in the front seat or the back seat initially to me does not make any difference. She found the back seat as the car settled into the water and assumed a conscious position, holding herself in the back seat of the footwell of the car. Now, remember, the car is upside down. She is right side up, as it were, but she's upside down within the car, if that makes sense. Her head is in the footwell of the car. She assumed a position such so that she could avail of herself of the last remaining air in that car. And when she died, she was holding herself still in that position. Now, we didn't find her the way you would find a person who was normally drowned, that is, lying in a prone position or just having slumped in the position which the water around her would let her fall. In other words, she was not on the roof of the car. She was actually holding herself at the surface of the water and died in that position of what we feel to be asphyxia from the lack of oxygen in her own air void. And this was at a much later date, backed up by the undertaker, Eugene Fry, who said to me before we went into the unbelievable atmosphere of that secret inquest, he said, as far as I'm concerned, he said to me, you are the only person that's made any sense in this whole thing. And I said, well, Gene, what are you talking about? And he said, well, you're absolutely right as to how the girl died. She did not die of a normal drowning. And I said, gee, I said, elaborate. I said, come on, we've been looking for this for a long while. The newsmen don't believe us. Nobody seems to want to believe us. What are you saying? And he said, well, it's very simple. I've embalmed over 24 bodies of victims that drowned. And he said, every single one of them was full of water. And I mean full. We're talking in terms of quarts of water in every single one of their organs, especially the lungs being full of water. And he said, Mary Jo was not full of water. As a matter of fact, when we evacuated the fluids from her organs, all of her organs, and he said, this is done in a normal case of all embalmings, you use what's called a troche, a very large needle to evacuate the fluids from the organs. And when we used that, we got no more than a half a cup of water out of her entire body. So he said, as far as I'm concerned, you're right. She suffocated in her own air void from lack of oxygen, having burned up the oxygen. And she did not drown, in that the water did not rush into her lungs and stop her air immediately. So I said, Gene, you planning on saying anything about this? And he said, I'll answer the questions they ask, but boy, I'm not going to offer anything. There's too big a fish to fry here.
He said, and I said, look, why don't you just say something about this, and then I plan on saying something about it when I get in the inquest. He said, no way. And I knew what he was talking about when I got in there, because we were not allowed to offer any information. And as a matter of fact, in the inquest itself, we were not asked anything that was pertinent to how long the girl may have lived.
Oh, boy, that even sounds worse than the book Teddy Bear.
Well, Teddy Bear
tells the whole story, I'm telling you.
Yeah,
it does. But to hear you tell it when you're actually there, I can hardly believe how all this has been covered up so long. And it just doesn't seem possible.
Well, it does seem hard to believe.
It's an amazing thing. It really is. And I'm so glad that you can tell these things to the listeners.
Well, I think that there are a lot of people that won't talk about this. There are many people in Edgartown that have even been, you might say, threatened, or pressure has been exerted upon them not to talk. But I think that people know that they might do better than to exert pressure on me to do something like this. We have talked honestly and straightforwardly from the time we came out of the water. As a matter of fact, the first time I realized that there was going to be a problem with this whole thing was when I brought the girl out of the water, having gone on what we call condition red, and that is to respond to an accident because there may be life involved. And I brought the girl up, and I looked at Jim Arena with the girl under my left arm, the cross chest carry on her, and I said, Jim, give me a hand. He said, my God, do you recognize her? Do you recognize her? And I said, what do you mean, recognize her? And he said, is it one of the clan? Now, this was the first time, and I've known Jim Arena a long while, I've ever seen Jim shook, literally shook. And he was scared, he was somewhat trembling. And I said, what do you mean, one of the clan? No, I don't recognize her. You see, I said, you mean one of the Kennedy clan? Because I had found out a matter of about a minute before I went into the water that this was Kennedy's car. And I said, one of the Kennedy clan? He said, yeah, you recognize her. And I said, you take a look. And I rolled her over on my shoulder so he could see the face. And he looked at her, and he breathed this great sigh of relief. He said, oh, thank God, no. No, I don't recognize her. I said, now, Jim, would you mind giving me a hand? There's a four knot tied trying to sweep this body away from me, and I'm tired. Would you please give me a hand with the body? And that was the beginning of the whole rattles that I got on this thing, a special treatment right down the line.
Well, who was Jim Marina? He was the chief of police, wasn't he?
Jim Marina was the chief of police, right, a former state police who had become the chief of police of Edgartown.
Now, Wally, do we have to take a break now?
Yeah, we can have a short break, and we'll get right back with Mayor Sam Yorty and his special guest, talking about, of course, Chappaquiddick and the Teddy Kennedy, Mary Jo Kopechne case. We'll be right back.
Now, you've been listening to my special guest, Captain John Farrar, head of the search and rescue mission of the town of Egerton, where the Mary Jo Kopechne body was found, where she was drowned. And believe me, it's so shocking to hear John Farrar. I thought I was shocked when I read the book Teddy Bear, just describing what he's telling us. But to hear the man who actually did the rescue work tell us about how she drowned and the possibility that she could have been saved is really shocking. And it shows the tremendous power that the Kennedys have in Massachusetts to keep all this covered up. Now, John, let me ask you again, from your 10 years' experience in rescue work, how long would you say Mary Jo Kopechne could have stayed alive in the submerged car?
Well, this is a pretty hard thing, naturally, to pinpoint exactly how long she could have stayed alive, Mayor Sam, but I would say that from the position of the car, her position, and the fact that I didn't point out, of course, I had discussions with the undertaker, and the fact that I didn't point out was that approximately 10 hours later, when the car was removed from the water by the wrecker, as the car was starting to move, copious amounts of air, and Judge Boyle would not admit to this or ask questions on it, and in fact denied it in his concluding statements. He said there was no proof of any air having remained in the car. This is an outright lie, because we were ready to testify and willing to testify, although we were not allowed to testify, as to the amount of air that was remaining in the car. There were copious amounts of air that issued from the rear section of the trunk, in other words, of the car. And when the car was removed, the first person to inspect the car was John Album. And when he opened the trunk, his statement was that the trunk was virtually dry or merely damp. So we know that there was still air remaining in the car when we removed it. All right, now, how much of this air was available to Mary Jo? I stated that due to the way the car entered the water and its position on the bottom, that there would have initially been copious amounts of air for her to breathe. There would have been enough so that she could have assumed that position and breathed air for a considerable period of time. Now what we'd look at is how long did it take the air to leak out of the car. All right, the main source of leakage of air in that particular car would have been, and its particular position, I might add, the trunk being high, would have been between the back seat and the trunk, in other words, out through the trunk. However, when we found the car, the trunk was still full of air. So I feel that she well could have lived for in excess of 1 hour, possibly even 2 or 3 hours.
Mm.
Certainly, I am confident of the fact that she would have lived for 25 minutes. Because don't forget, we have about 8 minutes grace period when she's expired, if we can still get to her and get air to her personally. So we've got 8 minutes to gain there before brain damage begins to set in. All right, it took us 25 minutes. Now, if you move the 8 minutes from the 25 minutes, it cuts your time, available time to you, or increases the available time to you even more. And due to the fact that we found the trunk still full of air and virtually dry, as they say, that means that we would have had terms, I'm sure, of hours left to us before she had expired.
Well, that really means what you're saying then, Captain Farrar. If Teddy Kennedy had reported immediately what happened, she could have definitely been saved.
Well, we can't say definitely because we were not there at the time of the accident, but I think that the odds are better than 90% that we would have saved her, yes, because we could have gone down and immediately increased the air supply to her. We would have immediately put a tank inside the car, in other words. We would have increased the air that she had to breathe, we would have freshened it, and then we would have gone inside and extracted it from the vehicle, probably using breathing apparatus.
Well, instead of reporting the accident, he was calling his lawyers and executive assistants and everybody else on the telephone and running around evidently trying to figure out what to do. But the one thing he didn't do was report the accident.
Yeah, this, of course, is where I indict him most highly for his lack of moral perpetuity, his lack of a moral code, in that he was obviously, he said that he, you know, the concussion, we've heard all the bit about how dazed he was. And yet, if he was so dazed, how was he so capable of making sure that he got the correct people to save himself, that was both lawyers, to save his own situation and discuss what they were going to do next. Whereas if he had been that much in presence of mind and that capable of keeping his wits about him to protect himself and his own career by the number of people he chose, why, my question is, didn't he call for help, even help in his own party that would have saved Mary Jo? And, of course, that was LaRosa. LaRosa is an experienced skin diver. Now, whether he had the equipment or not, he didn't have any equipment with him. But whether he could have done anything was questionable. But Kennedy obviously showed that he intentionally had no intention of saving Mary Jo because he didn't ask for help in his immediate surrounding party that would have, in fact, possibly helped save Mary Jo. And he certainly didn't intend to avail himself of all the facilities around to call for professional help that could have saved Mary Jo.
Oh, boy. Well, the book Teddy Bear suggests it could have been difficult, it would have been difficult for Senator Kennedy to have escaped from the submerged automobile through the window due to its size and because the car was upside down. Now, is this true?
I think that's probably very true. We've got to take his back brace into account as well. The man is 6'2". They claim weighs 220 pounds. That kind of a person doesn't get through the window of an automobile very well, especially if water is rushing in through it, which it would have been. However, there's something that the book does not take up at any great length, and I think that they disregard this considerably, and the press has disregarded it too, and that is the primary fact that Teddy Kennedy claimed that he was unfamiliar with the Dyke Bridge Road. He was unfamiliar with Chappaquiddick and made a wrong turn. This, of course, is another of the complex of lies because Kennedy was familiar with Chappaquiddick, thoroughly familiar with it, in that he was down there with Jack in 1955 when Jack was recovering from his back operation, and he spent some time with an individual down there with a family that we know, spent some time on the island. Now, they had driven around the island, and also, even more disgusting as far as I'm concerned, is the fact that he had driven that same road earlier the same day, and had swum down there, and so had the girls. So to say that he was unfamiliar with the road is ridiculous. All right, now let's say that he was familiar with the road. I think we're assuming that, we're stating that as a fact, from 1955 until that particular day, both situations. So he went down there with intent, and even Judge Boyle said that he went down there with intent. All right, and we know he knew the road. All right, knowing the road, and going down there at a high rate of speed, ostensibly to speed away from Hukluk, who, as far as I'm concerned, is telling the absolute truth. I've talked with him extensively, and he knows that that was the same car, even though Judge Boyle was successful in making him appear as though he could not possibly identify the car.
Well, wait just a minute there. We have to tell who this Look is. He's a police officer who says he saw Teddy Kennedy's car about 12:40 a.m. Is that right?
That's right. He was a deputy sheriff at the time. He is now the sheriff of Dukes County. And he saw the car at approximately 12:45 p.m. And, well, excuse me, it'd be quarter one in the morning.
And Teddy Kennedy had said that he took her in the car to the ferry, which the last ferry left at 12 o'clock.
That's correct. He said he left the party and that the accident happened. He said he left the party approximately 11:15 and that the accident happened shortly after that. And then his, quote, rescue attempts proceeded. However, I think that we've got to look at the situation and say that Hukluk saw the car, and there's no way he could see that car if it was already over Dyke Bridge. So it happened when after Hukluk saw the car.
Well, we have to take a short break, Captain Farrar, and then we'll be right back to you, and we'll get to the questions on the telephone, too.
Okay, well, I'd like to cover, too, this how he got out of the car.
Okay, we will, just as soon as we take this short break. Now, you're listening to Captain John Farrar, my special guest, who is the head of the search and rescue mission of the Edgerton Fire Department. And Captain John Farrar removed Mary Jo Fecklick's body from the automobile in which she was submerged. And he was telling us about the question of how Senator Kennedy could get out of that car in view of his size and the back brace and so forth. Do you want to go on with that, Captain?
Yeah, just briefly, we were talking about how he might have gotten out of the car. I think, first of all, I'd like to say that no, once the car entered in the water, there was no way I feel that he could have gotten out of it. Due to the pressure on the car, the tide that was involved, the tide that would have been there if the accident happened when Hukluk says it happened, or after Hukluk saw the car, the sheriff Hukluk, and there would have been no way. However, if we take the fact that Kennedy was thoroughly familiar with the road and the fact that the dike bridge was there, and we speed his car up to get it away from the sheriff, which the sheriff stated it did, it went down the dike bridge road at a considerable rate of speed. If we take that situation and assume that he approaches the bridge much faster than he's anticipating, and apparently, according to Brock Brower, who spent a lot of time with Kennedy doing an article with him, he drives at a horrendous rate of speed all the time. If we take that situation and suddenly the bridge looms up, and Kennedy realizes, and there were no skid marks except on the bridge itself, I might add, and Kennedy realizes that he is approaching the bridge and there is no way that he is going to stop the car from going over the bridge, as there were no corrective skid marks, at this point, he's got to realize the car is going over, and he begins his egress from the car and jumps out as it goes over the bridge and goes into the water. Now, this is conjecture on my part. There's no way I can prove this. There's no way anyone can prove it. But if he was, in fact, the driver of the car, which we have to give him credit for being because he said he was the driver of the car, and I don't care what anyone wants to believe, if he had not been the driver of the car, being thoroughly steeped in legalese as he is and being surrounded by legal means, he would have never admitted to being the driver of the car if he had not been, because he would put himself in a potential manslaughter situation. We have to assume that he was the driver of the car and therefore had to have gotten out, and I see that as the only way that he might have gotten out.
Well, Captain Farrar, in the book Teddy Bear, I think it says that Kennedy once said that the window of the car was open and once said it was closed. Is that right?
I don't remember a confusion on that particular point. As far as the window of the car, when we found it, the window was down. He did say that he remembers trying to roll down the window and trying to open the door. This is after the car ostensibly went in the water. And this is the way he was trying to remove himself. And then he says that he doesn't remember how. He remembers the sensation of drowning in the water entering into his lungs, quote unquote, and that he was drowning. And then suddenly he doesn't know how, but he was out. I'm sorry, but this just doesn't hang together.
The window was open then when you found the car.
Yes, as far as that goes, it was retracted to within approximately an inch of full opening.
Uh-huh.
That's correct.
Now, later, let's see, he says he later that night, I think, he swam the channel. And could you tell us your experiences in trying to swim across that channel between Edgerton and Chappaquiddick?
Well, I think, first of all, I'd like to go back briefly to what Brock Brower said the day after the accident.
Who's Brock Brower?
Brock Brower is a guy who did an article, one of the first articles that came out on Kennedy after the accident. And the accident was his wrap-up. He had been following Kennedy for a number of months prior to the accident, doing a story on him. And the accident itself was his wrap-up, and it was in Life magazine shortly after the accident. So I spent some time through another friend of mine down there with Brock to help Brock in looking into what we figured had to have happened or what we figured might have happened at the accident itself. And Brock Brower came up with some rather amazing statements. One of them was his propensity for parties, for high-speed driving. And the other that amazed me, and Brock says with absolute certainty that he has seen Kennedy, quote, swim, unquote, and that he can't swim. There is no way, he said, that he can swim with that back brace on. He goes into the water, he takes a couple of strokes, and he floats. Now, this is not my statement. This is Brock's statement, who spent several months with Kennedy. And as a result, if we take that, and then we take Kennedy's, quote, attempts, unquote, to save Mary Jo, his repeated dives, his exhausted condition, and then we put him into the Hellespont, and we have him swim from the 500 feet through what would have had to have been 2 to 3 knot currents, sweeping him out sideways across from Chappaquiddick to Edgartown. My conclusion is that it would have been an exhaustive swim, and I question very much whether anybody in that condition could have made it, but certainly nobody would have made it that had that could not swim, as Brock says he could not.
Well, didn't he say he swam it with his clothes on?
Yes, I believe that was part of it, that he came out dripping wet, yes, and he had his clothes on, and that, of course, makes it even more impossible because you know what clothes are as far as a drag goes. Yes, that's right. You said he jumped in with all his clothes on, the whole thing.
Including his shoes.
Yeah, that's right. With his shoes. I have made the swim, and it's a considerable swim considering the 2 and 3 knot tide. He also made the statement that the tide would have set him down to the lighthouse, which is, in other words, to the right, swimming from Chappaquiddick to Martha's Vineyard, the main island. The tide, he said, set him down toward the lighthouse. In actual fact, it would have set him the other way.
Oh, boy. Well, it looks like a tissue of lies and how they got away with it. There was no autopsy, was there?
No, there wasn't, and there was an awful lot of effort put into preventing the autopsy. There's no two ways about that. I think initially Dr. Mills did not want to upset the family. He's a heck of a nice guy and a very sweet guy, and I think initially his intentions were probably proper. He regrets now that there was no autopsy. He wishes he had gone for the autopsy, and he was advised by other doctors on the island to go for the autopsy and informed this, given this information by them. But his attitude would be, well, we don't want to disturb the girl and disturb the parents, that sort of thing. I don't really think he knew what of ball of wax he was getting into and what a red herring he was creating.
Well, did the district attorney order an autopsy and then the body was out of the jurisdiction?
That's right. You see, immediately after the accident, Kennedy, or somebody in the Kennedy machinery, assigned Dunn Gifford, who was one of the Kennedy men, to the body, and Dunn Gifford's main purpose was to get the body out of there, and that he did just as absolutely rapidly as possible. As a matter of fact, he brought the death certificate in for Donald Mills to sign, and Donald Mills signed it, and already pre-typed on the death certificate was that it was a simple case of drowning, and Donald was satisfied by his precursory examination, which lasted no more than 10 minutes. That she died a simple case of drowning, but he wasn't looking for anything else other than drowning. Being a simple man himself, he felt that there she was in the back seat of an automobile. She was dripping wet. There was blood foam, a very minute amount, but an amount of blood foam which issuing from her nose and mouth, which is indicative of drowning. This blood foam I saw myself, and he wasn't looking for anything else, such as anything you want to say, from manual strangulation to concussion, and as a result from his precursory examination, she was a simple case of drowning. But there was no autopsy. He didn't ask for one, and Denise didn't realize until really too late that he wanted an autopsy. When he realized what he was getting into, He asked for the autopsy and was given the bad information that the body had already left the island, when actually it hadn't, because there was plane problems. But by the time he found all this out, the body had went off the island roughly around 2 o'clock, I believe, in the afternoon.
And Denise was the district attorney.
That's correct, yes.
And he ordered an autopsy, and they told him the body was gone, and the body was not gone at that time. That's right, isn't it?
That's right, yeah. Lieutenant Killen had the wrong information. Lieutenant Killen thought it had gone, and he told Denise that, and the body had not gone. And by the time they got it all straightened out, the body was on the plane and gone out of his jurisdiction.
And then later, I think, the girl's parents opposed an autopsy, didn't they?
Yeah, then the whole scene shifts to Pennsylvania, and you get into interstate jurisdiction. And, of course, as I'm sure you can know, this can be a big red herring. And it was. A lot of us went down to testify at the autopsy hearing in front of Judge Kaminsky. And that became very rapidly apparent that although there was a lawyer there by the name of Flanagan, who set out to show that the parents didn't want the autopsy and went out to prove that nothing could be gained from the autopsy, that he was really not only speaking for the Kopechnys, but there were certain many things that he said was obviously he was defending Kennedy.
Well, can you give us a brief summary of your remarks at the inquest?
Well, this is a long time ago. I haven't really looked into that recently, but basically all we covered at the inquest was what we did from the time of receiving the alarm to the time of removing the girl, her physical appearance when we removed her, and when I touched on the fact of how we found her, the position we found her in, and mentioned a consciously assumed position such so that she could avail herself of the last remaining air in the car, and a virtual axe came down and we were cut off. There was no further interest or questions about that. As a matter of fact, I was cut off before I was able to finish the statement.
How long after her death was the inquest? You remember?
I think by the time we got through all the Kennedy objections in the Superior Court on up through the Supreme Court, the Kennedy objections to the form of the inquest, which was initially and had for over 150 years been open, I think by the time we got through that, it was roughly 6 months after the time of the accident that the inquest was finally held. And at this time, of course, Kennedy had had plenty of chance to align his answers so that the girls at the party, the guys at the party, and he all came up with strikingly similar answers to similar situations, or to a given situation, they all had the same answer from the inquest. If you read the transcript of the inquest, and you find, I don't know how many people have been involved in this sort of thing, but if you ask five people that were at a party the same question, it's very unusual if you get any one of the five to have an answer that's like any one of the others. There's always a different impression. But all these people happen to have almost exactly the same answer to given situations.
Well, why were you not summoned to appear before the grand jury?
Well, the grand jury itself, this was quite a thing, of course. Judge, and I'm trying to think of his name, whether it was Packett, I believe, that controlled the grand jury, he was sent down to run the grand jury, spent a long time charging the grand jury and telling them what they could cover and what they could not cover. They were not allowed to talk about anything that had been covered before. They were not allowed to call any witnesses. This was the final incriminating thing that I found out only later from one of the members of the grand jury, was that they were prohibited, absolutely prohibited, from covering any of the ground that was covered in the inquest, although they had no copy of the inquest, mind you. They didn't know what questions had been covered. They were not allowed to cover any ground that had been covered there, and they were not allowed to call any of the witnesses that had been called by the inquest. yet the inquest was not allowed to be released until there was an absolute statement by the district attorney or the prosecuting attorney that there would be no further legal action. All right, so what we got is a situation where, all right, we determined that there is going to be no further legal action. But how is the grand jury to determine whether there is to be any further legal action until they look at the inquest or call the witnesses which were involved in the inquest? Because all of us were strictly, were very important to the accident itself. So the inquest had sucked up all these witnesses, sequestered them, and then prohibited them from saying anything, and their statements were locked up and sealed in the Boston Supreme Court. And as a result, the grand jury was absolutely made powerless by this Judge Paget, and were not allowed to look at anything which had previously been covered. So as a result, they were powerless. They were rendered powerless by the judge of the Supreme Court.
Well, is it true that threats have been made on your life as a result of your statements concerning this Chappaquiddick affair?
Oh, sure. This one expects. This is something that you have to... you have to realize that it was probably the hardest part to deal with at first, because we were doing a job, being captain of the Search and Rescue Division of the Edgartown Fire Department. When we get a call, we go, and we are bent on saving lives. And when all of a sudden you do your best to save a life, and you're involved with the Kennedys, you suddenly become sucked up in the controversial aspect of the Kennedys, pro and con. And initially, I must say that admit that I lost a lot of friends, even on the Vineyard, who were pro-Kennedyites and who didn't like what I had to say. But as time went along, certainly within a matter of months, as the information began getting out and the lies began to be uncovered and the wrong turn statements came out. People, you know, obviously didn't believe it. I think I've gained back every friend that I ever lost due to this incident. Naturally, the calls, the long-distance calls, the letters, that sort of thing, came pouring in for over a year. They're now down to just a trickle, but occasionally they come in. It was only a while ago that we got a call from somebody in, I believe it was Gary, Indiana, threatening our lives. He was going to come and get us with a shotgun. So this still goes on, and it's something that I think that we have to, it has to be a part of our lives if we're going to stand up and make statements that we are and continue to say what we feel is right and honest.
Well, I think you've certainly got a lot of courage because you're in California, but to make these kind of statements in Massachusetts where the Kennedys control everything really takes a lot of courage, and I certainly congratulate you on having that kind of courage. I think very few people have it.
Well, you're nice to say so, Sam. I don't think it's as much courage as, frankly, it's something that has to be done. If we go along with the fact that we're going to shut up and just let the Kennedys continue to roll roughshod over the rest of the people of the United States with their pack of lies, then we don't have much personality going for us, do we?
Well, the final thing is that you feel that if you had been called immediately, there's a very good chance that Mary Jo Kopechne could have been saved.
That's right, Mayor, sir.
Okay, now...
we have to make a short break now. Now, if you have some questions that you would like to ask Captain John Farrar, you may call 520-KGBS or 520-5427 right now. In just a moment, you can talk to Sam Yorty and to his guest, Captain John Farrar. It's 923 with Mayor Sam Yorty. Yeah. There, and you can buy the book Teddy Bear, The Real Story of Chappaquiddick, and Solzhenitsyn's book, both available for your local American Opinion bookstore. Get the book and read the whole thing, especially Teddy Bear, right now at American Opinion Bookstore. Check the white pages of the telephone book for the American Opinion Bookstore nearest you.
Now you can call me on 520-KGBS and you can ask a question of me or Captain John Farrar. Good morning.
Hello.
Good morning.
Hello, Mayor Sam.
Yes.
This is Teresa. Hello, Captain.
Yes. Yes, Teresa, go ahead.
Hello?
Hello, Teresa, go ahead.
Okay. Now, I read this Teddy Bear, and I couldn't believe it. I read the first book that came out. Wasn't that the name of the Bridge of Chappaquiddick?
That was a different person. Jack Olson wrote the Bridge of Chappaquiddick. Jack Olson.
Oh, yes, I couldn't remember the name. That was it. I had the book, and I lent it to somebody, and I never did get it back, so I couldn't remember. But anyway, but this is much worse. I can't believe it. But I think you answered a question that I had. I was going to ask you, how was Kennedy able to use his private plane to take the body in out of the state? And you say that they signed papers in order to get, were given permission?
Yes, he was given permission by the medical examiner, Dr. Mills.
Oh, I see. Well, then that, because I don't think the book said that.
Yes, that it was covered there. And how that happened was the Kennedy machine quickly assigned Dunn Gifford, a very tall, imposing, forceful person, to get this job done. And he went right to the funeral parlor and he was able to get the embalming. Dr. Mills had put a hold on the embalming until he got word from Denise whether he wanted an autopsy or not. And what Dunn Gifford was able to do was to speed this whole process up, get Dr. Mills to accept that he didn't want an autopsy, get the embalming performed, charter a private plane, and get the death certificate signed, which had to be done to show the cause of death before Gifford was able to fly the body out.
All right, now, since he had that back brace, he could hardly have gotten out of that car through the window, if particularly if he had a neck situation. And didn't he have any contusions or lacerations or whatever if he had a fight to get out?
Yes, the doctors came up with quite an affidavit, 200 and some odd words, as to his condition after the accident. And it was supposedly to prove that he had been through quite a physical ordeal. But regardless of that, given the car in that water, at that situation, with that tide, if he had been inside the car, due to his size of his body, I do not feel he could have gotten out of the car the way he said he got out of the car. Now, if he was able to get himself to the air void, and then at a later date when the tide subsided and after the pressure equalized, he might have been able to open the car, to open the car door and get out. However, there was no comment or statement as to how he got out of the car. His statement was only that somehow he was suddenly out, and his statement was that it happened immediately after the accident while the water was still rushing in. Now, that's what I say would have been impossible.
Well, thanks, Teresa. Thanks for calling. We appreciate your call. Okay, you can call me or call Captain John Farrar on 520-KZBS. Good morning.
Hello, Mary Ordy?
Yes.
Mark from Beach.
Who?
Mark.
Mark, yeah.
And the question I had for Mr. Farrar, was there any reason why Deputy Look didn't follow the Kennedy car that night?
Yeah, is that your question?
Yeah.
Huck, as I call him, Huck looked very well. There was nothing suspicious particularly about the car that night. He was tired. He was not on duty. He had come off duty at the yacht club as on patrol, and he was on his way home. He merely stopped to offer them assistance if they wanted directions. I think it would help if you understood that Martha's Vineyard at that time was influxed by thousands of people for the regatta, and Edgartown and Chappaquiddick, per se, has thousands of people who are loaded into this weekend for a regatta. There are a lot of people who would conceivably be driving other people's cars and who would be lost on the Chappaquiddick Road if they were over there for a party or over there to go swimming, something of that nature. And so he was just being very nice and offering his help. There was nothing suspicious in the car itself, and certainly the fact that it sped off down Dyke Bridge Road was not in itself suspicious to him at the time.
Thank you, Mark. Okay, you can call us on 520-KGBS. Good morning.
Good morning. This is Robert from Los Angeles.
Yes, Robert.
And I'd like to ask the captain, does he intend to write a book on what happened at Chappaquiddick?
No, I don't intend to write a book at all. As far as I'm concerned, there have been a lot of books written on it. I think that the only book that comes up with any definite conclusions until we get any more information from Mr. Kennedy or his party goers, I think everything has virtually been said, with the exception of one or two items. I think everything has been said by the book Teddy Bear.
Have you been invited on any speaking engagements or television programs? Or being the person that pulled out the body, that puts you in a pretty delicate position, you know. So I was wondering if there was any demand for you to make speaking engagements or television, because you certainly could have capitalized on this.
Well, I don't, Bob, I don't like to think of it as capitalizing on it. As far as I'm concerned, if people such as you want to know more about it and want to ask questions, I'm going to answer the questions to the best of my knowledge and the best of the truth possible. I don't care to capitalize on it. I'm not making any money on it. So I just feel it is very important going into 76 elections. Due to the problem we've had, that everybody should know who they're voting for this time and what their background is before they vote.
Well, certainly after Watergate, I certainly agree with you. And after seeing how these people had been convicted at Watergate of making gobs of money writing books, I salute you for not capitalizing on this. And if it is true that the Kennedys run Massachusetts, as the mayor says, again, I take my hat off to you.
calling in showing knowledge of what happened. They've evidently been reading Teddy Bear. And I asked Captain Farrar if it's a fairly accurate account of what happened, and he said I let him say himself. What do you think, Captain?
Well, frankly, Mayor Sam, I tell not everybody that buys the book, but when I'm in my store, which is a fishing and sporting goods store, a lot of people come in to ask me about it. Many new people will come in and look at the book and not buy it. Then they go down to the bridge to take a look at the bridge and the numerous credibility gaps, as I call the water, the Hellespont, or the water that runs between the various areas. And they come back, and they not only buy the one book, but they buy three and four books for their friends, and they say, my gosh, it's just unbelievable. What do you think of it? And I say the same thing to everyone. I said, insofar as the accident is concerned, it is dead accurate. It is the closest thing that we can come up with as far as facts go until Kennedy decides to tell the truth.
Yeah, well, people keep calling and mentioning Sheriff Look and all. Obviously, they've read the book, and so other people who don't know what we're talking about will have to get the book. Teddy Bear, you can get it at American Pinion bookstores. It's only $2, and not only is it shocking, but it's very interesting to see how much they could cover up and how cleverly they did it and all the work they did to cover up. And I'm really more shocked today to hear Captain Farrar, who actually did it. I can't believe that he's really here. He really took the body of Mary Jo Kopechnik from the car, submerged in the water. It's all unbelievable that this could be so covered up.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, should we go to the telephone, Wally?
520-KGBS, the number.
Good morning.
This is Judy in La Cunada.
Yes, Judy.
I'm calling to ask Captain Farrar two questions. I just finished reading Teddy Bear, and one was in relation to another lady's question about whether or not Mary Jo could get out of the car. If she was conscious, and if she wasn't drunk, and if there was an air pocket, my husband, who's a scuba diver, says that once the water had equalized inside the car, she ought to be able to crawl out of the open window and get out of the car, at least, if not get up to the surface. Why didn't she try to do that?
That's a good question, Judy, and your husband is absolutely right. There has been a lot of this sort of information written on this sort of thing, especially since this accident. I have no less than 15 or 20 accounts sent to me by people from all over the country and Europe of accidents such as this, where people have gotten out of the car in exactly that way in some cases, but mostly where they have been removed by outside help once the pressure equalizes. Now, it's very likely that Mary Jo didn't know how to do this or was not did not have the presence of mind how to do this. Panic takes over in a situation such as this, and the only thing people can think about is up. Very quickly, I just want to say that I heard a scream the other night when I was asleep, and I went out, and my son was sleeping outside in a sleeping bag, and he had gotten turned around inside the sleeping bag, and he was trying to get up through the foot of the sleeping bag, and he was absolutely panicked. He had claustrophobia had set in, he was hyperventilating, and we, of course, dumped him out through the other side of the sleeping bag. But it reemphasized again to me that people in a panic situation and in a claustrophobic situation of being closed into something know only one way, and that's up. And that, for Mary Jo, was death. You have to have the presence of mind to realize that in this case, the car was upside down. You have to go down, out, and then up. And that is something that probably, if it did go through her mind, was anathema to her at that time.
Then the other question I had was, who is Zad Rust? We don't know who he is, and the book didn't say.
Zad Rust is the former foreign ambassador to Romania, Prince Michael Sturdze, as I understand. At the time, he used the name Zad Rust as a pseudonym because he was worried about recriminations from the Kennedys.
I see. Would you spell his last name for me?
Sturdza, I believe.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your answers. We're certainly interested in this, and we're buying the book and giving it to our friends.
Well, thank you, Judy. Thanks for calling. Okay, Wally, we got time for another call?
I think we might, unless you have some final things to say, Sam. We got about 2 minutes left.
Now, I just want to say again to Captain John Farrar that I guess the best thing to do if people are really interested in the details of this matter, and it's a fascinating story, is to get Teddy Bear. It's Teddy, B-A-R-E. I believe the book is available. I know it's available at American Pinion bookstores. But finally, Captain, the main thing is that it's your feeling that Teddy Kennedy had called for help immediately at the house nearby or even at the fire station, that there's a possibility that you could have saved Mary Jo Kopechnik.
A great possibility, Mayor Sam, a great possibility.
Well, that sums it all up, I believe, and the best thing to do, if you're interested, is get Teddy Bear. And otherwise, call us tomorrow and tell us what you thought of hearing Captain John Farrar. I've been very excited at having him here, and he's a very fine young man, a very clean-cut fellow, and doing a very courageous service to this country, in my opinion. And thank you all for calling today. Those of you who called made the show, and I apologize to those of you who tried to call and couldn't, because I wanted to have Captain John Farrar tell his story once and for all on our show. So I wish you a good day, and I hope you call us tomorrow.